We're happy to make podcasts available for selected EdWebinars for your listening pleasure. If you'd like to receive a CE certificate, you must watch the video recording and take the corresponding CE quiz. Recordings and quizzes can be found in the EdWebinar archives. Please visit home.edweb.net/podcasts for more information.
Good afternoon, everyone. I hope we're all going to get ready for a remarkable discussion of the fundamentally emotional nature of learning with Mary Helen Immordino Yang, who is revolutionizing the research in this field, and our very own Maida Tare. I should introduce myself. I am Barbara Pape, the Director of Communications at Digital Promise Global for the Learning Positioning Systems. But now let me introduce our featured speaker, who we're also excited can be here. Mary Helen has an impressive resume. She is Professor of Education, Psychology, and Neuroscience at the University of Southern California. She earned her doctorate at Harvard. She was elected president of the International Mind, Brain, and Education Society by the Society's membership. She is serving as a distinguished scientist on the Aspen Institute National Commission on Social, Emotional, and Academic Learning. Mary Helen also understands what it means to be a classroom teacher. She was an urban public junior high school science teacher. And in the words of Howard Gardner, Mary Helen is a pioneer in the interdisciplinary field of mind-brain education and author of many path-breaking studies, including the series of articles in her book, Emotions, Learning, and the Brain, Exploring the Educational Implications of Effective Neuroscience. I also want to tell you that she has a really cool cover on her book that was painted by a colleague. Maybe she'll mention that a little bit later. Mary Helen will speak shortly. I want to also introduce you to Maida Tare, who will launch our webinar. Maida is Senior Research Scientist at Digital Promise. She has more than 10 years of experience conducting applied research in the learning sciences. She holds a BA from Rutgers and a PhD in psychology from the University of Michigan. So, Maida, if you'd like to start with your presentation, we are anxiously awaiting.
Great. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. So I'm going to give a very brief overview of the Learner Positioning Systems initiative at Digital Promise Global, and then I'll turn it over to Mary Helen for our very excellent presentation. So the idea here is thinking about personalized learning and the goal of personalizing with a purpose so that students develop a love of learning and have the self-awareness that they need to succeed at their academic goals. So one of the reasons that we are seeing that more of a need for personalized learning is the increase in learner variability or learner diversity based on many different metrics in our student populations, so SES, learning disabilities, and others. So this diversity means that if you look closely at the components that lead to academic achievement, like vocabulary or memory ability, any given learner can actually fall anywhere on each continuum. So it's not that a learner is low on all of these things or high on all of these things. They can have a really varied profile. So that's why in creating the Learner Positioning Systems app, we actually take a holistic view of the learner and bring together the research that's been done. So I'm going to actually show you the web app right now. I'm going to share my screen. And this web app is, This web app is free and open to all who want to explore. And it is geared towards, you know, educators, product developers, people who are interested in learning more about all of the factors that lead to a learner's success. So currently we have two models posted. We have Math PK2 and Reading PK3. And I'll just go in there and show you how we've mapped out all of the different factors that lead to students becoming successful readers. So you'll see here that we have four categories, of course, the building blocks of language and literacy, cognitive abilities, social emotional skills, and then student background information. So emotion here, if you hover over one of the factors, you actually get to see all of the different factors that are related to emotion based on the research. And we know that emotion is an important factor, but we also know that now if you think about addressing emotion in the classroom for your learners, you can actually potentially impact the full diversity of learners in terms of cognitive skills like attention and working memory or background factors that students might be struggling with. And so that's how we're kind of helping people see all of the different ways that these factors impact students. If you click on a factor, you get more information, sort of a concise overview, main ideas and definitions. Of course, there's an ability to learn more about that factor. And another key piece of this web app, again, free and open to all to explore, is the list of strategies that support these different factors. So, for example, to engage emotion, we want to look at strategies that support students' interests and choice and build intrinsic motivation. So I'll just show you one for time purposes. But one factor or one strategy that supports emotion is incorporating students' cultural practices in the classroom. So again, a brief overview of what that strategy looks like, and then examples and videos of how it could be used in the classroom. And also for people who are interested in educational technology, how it could be used in a product. So this is just a very brief overview of this web app. You'll have the link to it in the slides, and I hope that people check it out. Back to you, Barbara.
Thanks, Maida. Thanks so much. We appreciate the explanation of what LPS is. And right now, Mary Helen, I'd like to turn this over to you. And thank you so much.
Well, hi. It's really odd to be sitting in my office in my house and talking to 1,000 people that I can't see. So I apologize for that weirdness. But nonetheless, it's super fun to have a chance to share with such a broad audience some of what we're learning about the nature of emotion, the way in which self-related processing, I mean, processing that kind of makes you you, that allows you to know who you are, to have a sense of experience, a sense of narrative of your own life, to have the things that you then can build out of that experience and narrative, things like purpose and ethics and relationships and values and meaning making. And what we're finding is that, you know, we often think of school-based learning and academics as being something that's kind of separate from emotion, maybe influenced by emotion, right? If you're not in the right mood, then you can't learn well. Or if you're upset, then it interferes with your thinking. And we think of emotion in these ways. But in actuality, what I would like you to understand over the course of the next hour is that emotion is not just something that's impacting cognition, that emotion, various aspects of emotion actually subsume cognition. Cognition is and emotion are actually two pieces of the same thought process. They're not separate things. As scientists, we like to distinguish them from each other because we can sort of study human thinking and behavior with an emotional light, or we can study it with a cognitive light, and we sort of bring to attention or sort of pull into focus different dimensions of the thought when we do that. But in actuality, in a real person thinking and learning in the world, there is no such thing as thinking without emotion, and there's no such thing as emotion without thinking. These things are completely intertwined with one another. They're two naturally occurring dimensions of the thought process and very, very fundamental to each other. It's impossible to think anything without emotion attached, right? You can't think of things deeply or remember things without any kind of emotion, because why would you, right? There's no reason for your brain to waste energy thinking about things that you don't care about. We've evolved to be very sort of sparing with the resources that we have inside our brain. And so it just wouldn't make sense to remember and think a lot about stuff that is irrelevant. We only remember and think about things that actually matter to us. You only remember and think about things about which you've had genuine emotion, on the one hand. And on the other hand, it's impossible to have an emotion without a thought, right? Thinking is what precipitates the emotion. It's your appraisal of a situation. It's your cognition about why things are happening and what's going on and what's likely to happen next that triggers the emotion response, right? So emotions and cognitions are actually pieces of each other's thought process dynamically. Emotion is a piece of the knowledge, not just as you're learning, but as you're recalling. So the way in which you've experienced thinking within a domain, even an academic domain, is actually shaping The way in which you then recall that knowledge later, the way in which you organize it in your mind. And so in that sense, knowledge is deeply intellectual and emotional at once. It's impossible, again, to have pure cognitions stuffed into your head. They just don't exist. Because why would your brain waste energy on things that you don't have any need for, right? And so you might be thinking, well, that sounds nice, but how can that possibly be true? You know, I studied, like, fill in the blank here, chemistry, art, whatever it is, and I couldn't care a hoot about that, and I managed to learn something about it. Of course, I don't really remember it now, but I did it then, and I got my A in the class, and I got into college, right? And you're like, well, what I would say to that is that it's really neurobiologically impossible to think deeply about or remember things about which you've had no emotion. So what do we do if people don't care about what they're learning, if there is no reason to learn it, if there's no intrinsic interest in the material, if you're not connected to it, if it doesn't feel relevant or meaningful? What we do is we come from the outside, from the institutional setup, and we impose reasons to have emotions. Like we say, well, you're going to fail, and then everybody's going to be mad at you, and then you're going to have to, you know, not go to college, and you're going to be, you know, everybody's going to be upset, or you're going to have to do summer school, or you're going to, or you're going to get an A, and everybody's going to be proud of you, and then you'll be able to, you know, do really well and get rich, or whatever it is you're going to do. But in both cases, the emotion that's allowing you to do thinking is coming from the outside. And sometimes a little bit of that is an okay sort of shortcut, but the sticky problem is that, remember, the brain only has deep memories and thoughts about things that you've had emotion about. And if the emotion is about the grade or the outcome or the, you know, what other people think, or, you know, getting in trouble or being rewarded, either one, then that is what you will remember, not the content, not the deep experience of thinking within the domain that the schooling is meant to be about, right? You remember the grades. You remember how you felt when you got the grades. You remember how you felt when you got accepted to college or when you failed out of, you know, whatever it was. You don't remember the physics itself and the way in which it feels to think in that domain. And so what I've been arguing for some time is that it's really essential for us to start to change the education system so that the emotion that people experience when they're teaching, you're human beings and thinking too, when you're teaching, when you're learning, when you're interacting with difficult material and concepts and relationships and complex contexts, that those ideas and activities and experiences are themselves intrinsically motivating and connected to things you care about and facilitating a person developing emotions that we know help thinking and learning, like interest and curiosity and agency in the academic domain, being aware of your own knowledge and feeling like what you're working on is something you own that you are intrinsically motivated to do. And there are various ways in which schools can promote those kinds of feelings in students and in teachers. And all of those are basically have a couple of things in common. They give learners and teachers a lot of autonomy to work on things they care about. They set up a context where people feel supported and like they belong, and where their relationships, either professional relationships in the case of teachers, or peer and professional relationships in the case of students and families, are genuinely on board with the same kinds of learning and thought processes that the kids are being asked to engage with in their learning. And these kinds of cultural attributes within schools are absolutely critical to supporting children and teachers and their brains in engaging deeply with the material, rather than sort of superficially memorizing things or engaging with things just enough so that you can pass or so that you can get by, but you're not going to remember it later. You're not going to innovate within that domain. You're not going to actually be able to apply it later when you get into another context. And so if I turn my attention now to the slides, right, I started with the first slide is the one that's on the cover of the book that Barbara alluded to, which is a beautiful painting by a friend of mine, Margaret Lazzari. She's the chair of the Fine Arts Department at USC. And she did a whole series of paintings that she called Wild Biology, which I just love this one especially as a metaphor for the relationship between cognition and emotion and thinking and education in brain development. So if you look at this beautiful seascape of life that she's painted, in real life, it's like a 6 by 8 foot vibrant seascape of color. She's got little weeds growing at the bottom and little yellow sunlight shining down from the top. And in the middle are these kind of white, squiggly, semi-translucent things floating there, right? Which kind of look like maybe waves or like, you know, reflections of the clouds. What they actually are is the white matter from one woman's brain. So we put a woman in the fMRI scanner. We took pictures of her brain. And then we peeled off the outside of her brain, all of the little cells, the cortical cells that are around the outside folds of the brain that are the neurons that actually do the firing, right? We peeled those off the image, the picture, not off the woman. And then what's left underneath those cells is this massively interconnected, literally billions with a B, of interconnected little microscopic threads of salt water that are incredibly fragile little tubes that are transmitting electrical signals to as many as, you know, 200,000 to 400,000 other neurons, and then collecting up information. And so in the end, what results is this amazingly complex network of interconnectivity of neurons into this delicately nuanced set of sort of subnetworks of communication that are feed forward and back, that are organizing themselves together in a balanced way in accordance with the person's genetic predispositions and experiences and thinking patterns and relationships, all moving and changing the dynamic balance of these networks throughout development, throughout the lifespan. And when we think about brain development this way, rather than as like sort of a, you know, the brain being kind of like a lump of 3 pound mush that's in your head that, you know, everybody kind of has one, and we sort of get stuck with a certain kind of brain. And as a teacher, you get stuck with, you know, 25 or 30 kids' brains. And like, you know, some brains are happy ones and some are dyslexic ones and some are smart ones. And, you know, whatever it is, however you want to, you know, label those things, that's actually not at all how I think about the brain. How we're starting to really think about the brain in terms of learning and development and education is much more like this painting that Margaret has, where the brain is sort of the connectivity of the brain and the networks of that, of those cells back and forth around the space of the head, and also all the way down into the body and back up again into every reach of your fingers and your toes, right? To make your central nervous system all feeding together. That these networks are not sort of independent from the rest of the person or the rest of the context, or stuck inside your own body in the sense of being independent from the context, but instead they're highly experientially organized. So the brain is sort of floating, if you will, in a world of other people, of culture, of situations, of experiences that are literally bolstering and sustaining that brain as it sort of floats semi-translucent in this beautiful ocean of life that's holding it up. And what I love is that Margaret has, you know, little red fish swimming by to represent the spontaneity of our creative ideas. And she's got these kind of swirly patterns of kind of floating of this brain in the ocean of the world. And that's really how I like to think about brain development. It's situated in the context in which the person lives. And it cannot exist without relationships and experiences to organize it. And if you think this is just sort of metaphor, there's a very heartbreaking but poignant example from Chuck Nelson and Nathan Fox and their colleagues, who did a very famous longitudinal study of institutionally raised children in Romania. These institutions have since been closed because of this work. So these were studies of infants who were brought by their biological parents to be raised in the institution, starting from newborn stage, because their parents couldn't care for them. And what Chuck and his colleagues did was they, by collecting outside resources from foundations and other organizations in the world, they funded as many of those babies as possible to go into foster care with families who were specially selected to care for them and raise them as adoptive children, basically. And then it's so heartbreaking, but they pulled kids' names out of the hat. And when they ran out of foster families, the rest of the kids stayed in the institution where they had been brought. And they followed the kids through time growing up. And, you know, we knew that we would find out that, you know, children who are living in institutions who, by the way, were being supported by all the physical needs met, right? They had diapers, they had food and milk and formula, they had beds and heating in their building and toys to play with, right, that were being provided. But what they didn't have was families who love them and stable ongoing relationships with an adult who is invested in them personally. Instead, they had a kind of rotating staff of caregivers coming in and out of their life every 8 hours. And, you know, we thought that that would lead, you know, to kind of emotional dysregulation or maybe social awkwardness or maybe even cognitive delays. But what we actually found out was ever so much more heartbreaking than that. I mean, what Chuck and his colleagues revealed is that, you know, kids were 17 years old and only 3 feet tall, and their brains were the third the size of a normal 17-year-old child, of the children who were put into foster care. And what this really underscores in a horribly heartbreaking way is that the legacy of our human intelligence and our incredibly exquisitely malleable and plastic brain development that grows and develops over time through extensive experience is that this is both both an opportunity for highly creative, acculturated thinking that isn't innate, that's grown by experience and by learning, and it's a liability and a responsibility for education and for families to engage with our children, because it's through these social engagements and acculturated ways of relating and loving one another and learning together and interacting in rich ways in the world and producing meaningful work that represents our thinking, that shares our sense of self with others, right? If you think of little kids doing drawings and things like that, it's those activities that are literally growing the brain. And without them, the brain does not grow. People are literally physically stunted. And we now know that neglect, social neglect in particular, is among the most devastating things that can happen to a young human being, and really results in profound problems with brain development and with the cultural and cognitive and social and emotional learning that relies on that brain development over time. And so the flip side of this conversation is that we have a responsibility in education and in society more broadly, education broadly construed, to engage with our young people in ways that make them feel safe, interested, agentic, engaged, purposeful, like they have meaningful decisions to make about their own life, like they are actually in charge of the things that they're learning and engaging with and producing, and like they can be genuinely proud of what they've learned and use that then to further decide what to do. We need much more kind of agentic, genuine, authentic engagement with the learning process and the relationships between teachers and students and among teachers and students, because we are all human beings whose intelligence and well-being literally depends on that. So the big kind of lesson of what we've been learning from the neural data is something like you see in these jack-o'-lanterns from my kids a couple of years ago, where, you know, you can't see the candles that are burning inside these little pumpkins, right? But we're trying as teachers, as neuroscientists, to use whatever tools we have available to try to infer or figure out what's the nature of that light and heat inside that little pumpkin, and how can we build a world around that child so that they can optimally grow and live and learn and develop into the full potential that they bring, into the person that they are capable of being. And what I would argue is that what we're learning about emotions in particular is that, you know, we've known for a very long time, since Darwin and before, that emotions are automatic responses to situations. When certain kinds of cognitive appraisals are made, when you interpret the world in particular ways, you have a packaged reaction that is an entire organized set of behaviors and thought patterns together that kind of shift your physiological and cognitive state. So if you think of, for example, fear as a very straightforward emotion to understand, you know, if I take the most prodigious mathematician in the world and hang her over the edge of a cliff by her fingernails and ask her what 2 + 2 is, right? Her mind, because she's in this frightened state of falling, right? Because she's appraised her situation as one that could turn out really badly for her survival, right? Is her physiology is shifting. Her heart rate is going up. Her blood pressure is going up. Her digestion is stopped, and all the blood is shunted out to her skeletal muscles so that she can mount the strength to like escape or fight or flee or, you know, somehow get out of there. And critically, her mind has shifted to thinking of strategies to fight or flee, right? That is a piece of the emotion reaction that we call fear. And so what you can see is that the reason she doesn't know 2 + 2 at that moment is because her mind is in an emotion state that's unconducive to thinking about that kind of content. So if you extract from that simple example of fear, which is all too common in schools, actually, that's what stereotype threat and other things like or anxiety for tests and things, right, are literally stealing away your cognition about the material you're supposed to be tested on, because you're in a place where you're thinking of strategies to escape, flee, fight, save your face, right? So you're not embarrassed, so that your life doesn't end, so you don't get humiliated by not knowing. These kinds of emotion states are also cognitive states, and that's why emotion is so critical to learning. So what we're finding is that emotions, that the reaction that you have, you can't, you don't need to actually control directly. You don't tell your heart rate to speed up and your blood pressure to increase or decrease in accordance with the situation. And it's a good thing, because we would have been dead if you had to think about all those things every time something happens, right? And manually adjust everything, right? But luckily, evolutionarily, that's all done for us in a big subconscious package, that automatically is triggered when you think of certain things. And what I would argue is that the most important thing for education to be thinking about and for educators to be thinking about is the process of learning how to feel. So what I want you to understand is that emotions happen first, and then we feel back what happened. We feel that back literally on the somatosensory cortices in our brain, right? On the same places in our brain that feel when you have a stomach ache or when your heart's pounding. We sort of conjure an understanding that is like a story we tell ourselves of why it is our body and our mind is being, you know, sort of shifted in this way, and what it means for the nature of the world, for the nature of ourself, for what we should do next, for who we are, for what we're capable of. So the emotion is the first step, but then it's your ability to actually experience that emotion and understand it, to make meaning of the situation, that is enabling you to use the emotion in a way that's going to project your learning in an advantageous direction, or undermine your ability to do complex work, because you're moving yourself into a direction that's actually not advantageous for learning. So what I would argue is that for teachers and for students, it's really a process. Development is really a process of learning how to feel. And that's a highly cognitive process. It's a process of being able to understand and make sense out of the factors that are going into the reaction you're having and using those to steer your thinking. This is true in the social realm, right? How do you react in the social situation? But it's also very much true in academic thinking. Like if you're trying to solve a math problem and you're kind of thinking and you're looking at the different solutions and you're thinking, wow, oh, no, that doesn't seem right. Oh, wait, I know something about this, right? Oh, no, wait, that's down the wrong path. Oh, wait, it's something about these quadratic equations. Then you come back again. Every little steering of your cognition that you're doing is triggered by an emotional reaction. That is actually emotion steering your cognition through the problem-solving space. And that emotional signal is critical to being able to access the memory and actually make sense of what you're doing and staying on task and focused and attentive. The problem comes when our emotions about how it feels to navigate math, right, or physics or art or whatever it is you're doing are swamped by some other emotion which seems much more salient, like everybody's going to think I'm stupid, or I look like this group, so I can't be good at math. Nobody expects me to be good at math because I'm this kind of kid, and that kind of kid doesn't do that stuff. Those kinds of thoughts are unfortunately much more salient emotionally than the thoughts of feeling what it feels like to understand something, which are small little thoughts at first. They're kind of feelings that you need to get all the noise out of the way before you can appreciate that emotional engagement and really feel what it feels like to think like a historian, right? Or to engage with something you really understand and explain it to somebody else. Those kinds of emotions that are steering your cognition, your curiosity, your interest, right? Those emotions are the ones that we really need to be promoting in schools. And oftentimes when we think about quote unquote social emotional learning or social emotional and academic development, the conversation turns just to emotions that are kind of managing yourself in the social realm, which are important, don't get me wrong. But it tends to be about emotion regulation, which by that is usually meant only down regulation of negative emotion, right? Not up regulation of curiosity or up regulation of interest or commitment to an important idea, which is also emotion regulation, right? Learning to be curious, learning to be dedicated and committed to an, to understanding something thoroughly. And then it also is as if, you know, your ability to manage yourself well in the emotional world and in the social world is sort of a precursor to your being able to do math, but it's not actually directly relevant to math. And I would argue that that is not the case, that being able to actually manage your thought process as you engage with a difficult academic problem is an inherently a problem of managing your emotion. And by managing, I don't mean doing away with it or putting the kibosh on it. I mean actually being able to feel the emotion in a way that's going to steer you productively so that you actually use that emotion to help you solve the problem, to help you keep working, to help you be interested, to help you understand why, and to help you find the memories that are relevant and push away the ones that are not relevant to what you're doing at that moment. So I hope at this point you're getting an appreciation for the fact that emotion is an inherent part of the learning process. It's not something that's just impacting the learning process or that you need to manage before you can engage in the learning process. The emotion itself is a piece of the learning process, and it needs to be treated as such and fostered as such. So this is just an example of kind of what I mean. So this is a song written by my daughter when she was six for her little baby brother, Theodore, whose name is, she called him Teddy. And you can see kind of it's a crayon drawing she did, right? You can see her with her little music stand there. And she's, I won't sing for you, I'll just read it. But she says, oh, Teddy, we love you more than the whole earth size. As the earth spins every day, we love you as much as usual, but sometimes even more, as you make us proud and happy that you're you. Right? I mean, very sweet little song that a little sister wrote for her little brother. But let me ask you one simple question about this also. As teachers, is this a song about her love for her baby brother, or is this a song about this little six-year-old's budding knowledge of planetary science? Right? Our knowledge of the world and our feelings of relationships are actually fodder for each other as we engage in the learning process going forward. It's both things. And then this is something Teddy did, just to kind of point out the individual variability in learners and how they engage with different kinds of young skills. And what I want you to see here is that he's a really, really different kid. He has a very different inclination to the world than his sister. You know, here he is with, you know, a letter that he wrote to me and my husband. This is the picture of the envelope on the outside. And he wrote, you know, Mom, Dad, Teddy. And you see little hearts floating and little faces in the letters, which I can talk about the faces and the letters sometime. But the basic idea, I think, is that many kids, as they're learning to read, when you learn to read, your brain has to actually co-opt facial emotion expression processing as a way to understand what letters are, because letters are the only thing in the world besides faces and emotional expressions on faces that are lateralized, that it actually matters if it's facing this way or it's facing this way. It's not the same thing. This is a C, this is a U, right? And in faces, there's subtle differences in left, right of smiles and things like that that give you clues as to whether the person really is genuine or whether they're deceiving you, or things like that in emotion. And what we know is that there's no evolutionary precedent for learning to read in the brain. It's an extremely difficult task for a brain to learn to do because it's very, very unnatural to our brain. And so the way that most people's brains manage it is by co-opting the fusiform gyrus, which basically manages facial expression processing. So when Ted got to this stage, he kept saying that the letters were looking at him and staring at him and jumping on the page, which, you know, kindergartners sometimes say. And so his way of dealing with that was to put little faces into all the letters. So that's what he did for a little while. And here's the inside of his card, right? He was in kindergarten. Dear Mom, oops, sorry, scratched that out, like mixed upper and lower case and stuff. But he's got the idea. Dear Mom and Dad, I love you. !! Theodore, !! You know, and he came to me as he was working on this on his own in the other room, and he came over to me and he said, Mom, how do you spell Theodore? And so I told him, and I said, you know, Teddy, I'm just curious, like, you know, why are you asking? And he said, I'm writing you my first letter, right? I mean, people produce their finest work, right? They drive themselves to learn new things when it really matters to them personally, when they're trying to engage in a representation of their own knowledge to somebody else, when they're trying to share what they know and put it out in the world in a way that makes them proud and that solves some communicative function, right? And that's what he's trying to do. I mean, I could have sat him down and forced him to memorize the word Theodore with a flashcard, right? But he naturally wanted to do it because he felt that his full name was the proper way to do something really serious, like write the very first letter of your entire life. And so he went and learned it on his own. And I just want you to appreciate the sort of social embeddedness of and the cultural knowledge that undergirds that kind of a learning, activity for him. And then here's where Ted really shows us what kind of kid he's going to be, right? On the back of the envelope, this is a picture of the back of the envelope, is this little diagram. So I asked him, I said, Teddy, you know, what is that? And he said, oh, those are instructions for how to open an envelope. It's in two colors. The blue is the little arrow that tells you where to look, right? If you want to open an envelope, you should focus on the point at the bottom, okay? And then you put a little box around that. And then what you should do is you put your finger in the side and you lift the paper up and up and up. And that is how you open an envelope, right? I mean, you could worry about Teddy based on his kindergarten writing skills being a little bit less than his sister's, right? But what he's showing us is that he's thinking in all the ways a kindergartner should be thinking. He understands this complex geometrical shape that is, you know, being used to make an envelope and the progression of instructions linearly through time and representing that for somebody else, right? In a way that actually matters. He's telling his parents how to open the envelope because he's proud that he's figured it out. Now, does he think truly that we don't know how to open envelopes? I doubt it, right? He's using his own ability to represent the world, and he's learning from his own personal experiences and relationships how to build skills that are going to allow him to achieve what he wants in the space of his world, his personal world, which in this case was to write his very first letter to his parents, right? This is my little nephew. And I'm sorry, by the way, that the slides, you can't have the slides. It's because there's all this stuff in here, like pictures of my nephews and stuff, which I can't, I don't have permission to distribute. All right. But what Gil is kind of showing us here by, you know, looking at his mom, my sister, right, in the mirror, is that feeling emotions that allow you to learn involve the very same brain systems that allow you to construct and regulate a sense of self. And I mean that in the literal sense of maintaining consciousness as compared to coma, right? And for feeling and regulating the state of your visceral body, right? Like gut feelings. And what we're finding is that this is literally neurobiologically true, that the learning process and the ability to experience deep thinking is literally hijacking and reworking the same neural systems that allow your body to survive and your physiology to be managed in the space of your daily world. And I think that that makes perfect sense from an evolutionary standpoint. I mean, the purpose of our brain originally is to control and manage our survival, right? It keeps you from falling off cliffs and makes you remember to eat and makes you want to like procreate and makes you stay warm and affiliate effectively with other organisms and stuff like that, all the way through in ways that become more complex as intelligence grows. But in the case of humans, we've gotten to a point where we even need formal educational experiences. We need to take people and systematically expose them to particular kinds of experiences and opportunities in order for them to grow the ways of interpreting and understanding the world that are so culturally situated that they're going to need to be able to live. Things like learning to read and write and think critically and engage with science and think about the use of evidence in the construction of arguments and think about music and art as forms of human expression that get at, you know, the ethics of the experiences that undergird our societal sort of co-creation of values, right? All of this is in essence tied to the survival mechanisms that it's originally based in and that it's co-opting and sort of hijacking over the course of human development. And when you think about learning and thinking that way, it becomes so obvious why our relationships and our emotions and our experiences as we subjectively perceive them are so closely tied to what we're capable of learning and doing. They're not separate things. They're enabling one another through a kind of co-opting process that's literally reworking basic survival mechanisms to also support complex thinking. So I'm going to show you a little bit about what happens in the brain when people feel complex, deep, what you might call deep states that are associated with learning, inspiration, right, for another person's virtue, or compassion for another person's pain, when you really are engaging with the complexity of that person's experience in context, in relation to the beliefs and values that you hold about how the world works, about how it should or could work, about who you are in that world, about who that person is in this world. It's incredibly complex cognition that goes into something like feeling inspired by someone else. I want you to appreciate that even though we're studying emotion, we're actually not just studying emotion, we're studying thinking, which is emotional and cognitive at once. And so in the very first study that we published of the neural correlates of these complex emotions like inspiration, what we found is that we had some very basic high-level activations in structures that are not just involved in thinking in really complex ways like the prefrontal lobes, right, and goal orientation and stuff, but the structures that are known, have been known for 50 years since neurosurgery experiments, actually 70 years now, since neurosurgery experiments in the 1950s, where Wilder Penfield and his colleagues were trying to cure intractable epilepsy, right? And what they basically did before we had neuroimaging is they would put a patient to sleep, right? Open up their head, wake them back up again. And then you can't feel anything on your head because you have no neural receptors on the surface of your brain. And before they would resect the part of brain that they thought, cut out the part of brain that they thought was causing the electrical storms, the seizures that were disrupting a person's life, They wanted to poke around in there and make sure that they weren't going to take out some basic function like language or something. And over the course of many of those surgeries to save people's lives, he basically mapped out the first maps of the living, awake, functioning human brain. And his patients were very willing to help him because they were really desperate for, you know, for scientific advances in the way, in our understanding of how the brain works so that they could be cured. And what he found was that if you look at these pictures of the brain, so this is one person's brain from our experiment, and then I'm going to take the data, the changes in blood flow from, a whole bunch of people who came to the lab, 17 people, I think in this case, who came to the lab and, interacted with these stories of real, true people, almost like mini documentaries of people who are really inspiring or compassion inducing or not that emotion inducing, like just sort of everyday interesting stories about people, which the participants, unbeknownst to them, were mixed in order for us to have a range of emotion strengths and thought processes when people were in the scanner. And what we found is that our first hypothesis, if you look at the brain on the right, it's sliced through someone's head this way, right? So the top of it is the forehead and the bottom of it is the back of the person's head. And on the sides are kind of two little C-folded shaped tissues folded underneath. You can see it in another view here. This is from Grey's Anatomy, the textbook, right? Not the TV show. And, you know, the eyeball goes in the little fold towards the left underneath, right? And, so the, in the picture, the brain has been resected, kind of opened up, and you can look inside, and there's this big, piece of tissue that's folded underneath called the insula, because it's kind of insulated underneath. And we knew from 1950 with Wilder Penfield that if you poke around in the front part of that, in the front part of that insula, when a person's awake, what happens is that they vomit. Or they get other kinds of, you know, gastromotoric responses that I won't describe in polite company. And so we knew that this is visceral somatomotor cortex. It's literally the cortex in your brain that's controlling and feeling what's happening in your intestines, your guts, your heart, right? And what we wanted to know is when people feel inspired by another person's achievements and mental qualities, when people engage with deep thinking about the meaning of how a situation, about the meaning of a situation or about the implications of the situation for their own life, for the things they could learn from this other situation that they're experiencing, right? People told us that, and, you know, poets have been describing for millennia, you know, hearts fluttering with love or a rock in the pit of your stomach at bad news or just, you know, feeling like physically nauseous and disgusted when something is morally repugnant, right? How is it that we come to experience those social values and emotions in a way that's so mapped onto our visceral guts? We wanted to know whether people are literally activating the brain systems that control and regulate their viscera when they're thinking about values and beliefs and morality and ethics and inspiration and self. And what we basically found is that, so what I'm going to show you is we took all the blood flow trial by trial when a person said in the scanner, I'm hugely moved by this story right now. I'm really thinking about what it means for my life, what it means for the world. Like I'm incredibly inspired. She makes me want to really do more with the resources I have in my own life, right? Compared to when people were saying, you know, that's a really nice story about those high school kids who donated the proceeds from their like, you know, drama production to a local library. And that's great. I wouldn't say I'm like hugely overwhelmed emotionally by it. Like I'm really deeply thinking about it, but you know, but it's nice. And we are contrasting the two blood flow states. So where in the brain, across all these people, across all these different stories they're watching, is there systematically more blood flowing when they say they feel subjectively moved and are really thinking deeply about something and are really inspired by it, as compared to when they say, you know, I'm thinking about it and it's interesting and there's lots of information here, but I you know, I'm not really I can move on now. Like, I'm not really that moved by it. I'm not really that, you know, concerned with it. And so what you're going to see is a map of the places in the brain where there was systematically more blood flowing in orange. So what is really important to note is that all the rest of the brain that stays gray in this picture, it's not that it's not being used to do this kind of thinking. It's that it's being used the same amount, whether or not you feel inspired, right? So that's also a really important finding, that there are many places in the brain that are, you know, being engaged in a complex task like this. But in order for that task to be remembered and sort of dwelled on and really thought about and to feel inspiring so that you're motivated to continue thinking about it and to work hard on it, here are the regions that were involved in that process. So the first thing that you see is there's massive activation in these two anterior insula, right? These are literally the places that Wilder Penfield poked and people puked. When people feel engaged with their learning, they are literally feeling and playing that out on the sensation of their own guts. No wonder our social and emotional and cultural lives are so tied to our ability to think deeply about math. And others have now found that these same regions are activated when people like mathematicians are asked to judge how interested they are in a really elegant equation as compared to an equation that is sort of true but awkward and not very explanatory in the world, right? This isn't just about social stuff. This is about academic knowledge too. Things that feel subjectively meaningful to you and connected to who you are, that you can really appreciate, that move you, that inspire you, are literally engaging the same neural systems that activate and feel what's going on in your guts and your viscera. And over here on the other side, we're looking right in the middle of this person's head, right? We have activations. This white stalk right here up in the middle of their head above the back of the roof of their mouth, right? Here's their nose and here's their spinal cord. This is the brain stem. We share this with alligators, right? Every vertebrate has one of these. It's a very densely packed little stalk of nuclei that are arranged in ways that are literally intermediating between the brain up here and the body down here, right? This is absolutely essential for survival. We have no conscious control over the brainstem, right? The brainstem is involved in monitoring things like consciousness. You get damage in here, you get persistent vegetative state, you get coma. And if you get damage down here, this is the medulla. This is a little bump right above the spinal cord. The medulla, literally, this is, if you get damage in here, we can't even keep you alive on life support because your heart stops beating, you stop breathing, and your physiology becomes completely dysregulated. Think how powerfully these results speak to the role of deep emotional engagement in the learning process. When people feel inspired by what they're engaging with and learning, they are literally activating the parts of the brain that make you conscious, that make you awake and aware and alive and have a sense of self. You are literally becoming more awake and more engaged in your own life. And another way to say that is more purposeful, more motivated, more engaged, right? Over here, this right here is the hypothalamus, right? What the hypothalamus is involved in is managing and sort of tasting the chemical content of your blood and moderating things like thirst and hormone levels, right? This suggests that when you're inspired by what you're thinking about, you are literally revealing and tasting and changing the chemistry of your blood, right? Learning is a deeply embodied emotional situated process. It's not something separate from who you are. So emotions and their primitive counterparts, something like biological drives, right? The drives that make us eat and breathe and affiliate, right? Are there to keep us alive and well. They keep you from being eaten by tigers and they make you, remember to breathe. But what I would argue is that among humans in this late stage in our evolution, right? Survival and wellness are now complex cultural and social constructs. And if you think of education as being one of the systematic ways in which we provide opportunities for people to build emotions about ideas, about values, about skills, right? Then what this means is that the reason those skills and values that you're learning about in school are so powerful in determining what you're capable of as a person over the course of your life is because they're literally reworking the same neurobiological systems that keep you alive. It's a little cute note from a kid in second grade when I was working in a classroom where this little girl was reading about the empty pot, right? Which is a story of an emperor who needs to choose his successor. And you probably know this. Anybody knows the reading arts curriculum, but, he cooks all the seeds and then asks them each to grow them into a flower. And of course, none of the flowers grow. And all the kids like fake it with another seed and bring this beautiful flower to be chosen as the emperor. And one little kid shows up and says, oh, my seed didn't grow. I must be like a terrible next emperor. And of course, he's the person who gets chosen. Right. So she says, you can learn, you should always be honest. Suppose someone caught you trying to be dishonest. How would you feel? I would feel shivery and ashamed of myself. Right. Who taught this little girl that when people aren't proud of your intentions that are hidden inside you, right, with of your qualities of mind, that is just the same as being sort of shut out from the physical warmth of well-being, right? That you're literally physically cold as if you're alone and outside by yourself when people aren't proud of your intentions. Okay. I'm just gonna skip us ahead a little bit. So to kind of sum up, emotions may be automatic responses, but we need to learn how to feel them. Because it's in the feeling of emotions that we actually steer our cognitions and our thoughts and drive the learning process. When we try to divorce our learning from the rest of our lives, that is really incommensurate with the way that the brain forms and retrieves memories and uses the memories from the past to steer yourself into the future. I'm going to skip this next part because we start a little later. But I'm just going to give you some basic summary of it. So let me put this up here. So there was two main findings from the data that I want you to take away. The first we've just gone over, which is that emotional feeling states recruit the neural systems that map visceral body states. And this has incredibly important implications for how we teach and learn. And the second, which I haven't talked about yet, is that emotions that are about ideas, that are about beliefs and situations that you can't see, which is pretty much most of the important emotions past preschool level in school, right? Emotions that are about understanding, that are about intentions, that are about, possibilities. Those emotions activate a network whose pattern of activity in the brain is fundamentally incompatible with external attention. It's called the default mode network. I've written a lot about this. Chapter 2 in the book, I think it's chapter 2, is completely about this. The idea is that these emotions are activating a system inside the brain that we know becomes profoundly deactivated the moment you start moving your pencil on the paper and sort of producing activity, 1, 2, 3, all eyes on me, you're watching what's going on around you and you're attending in the traditional sense. And you know sort of intuitively, you can't be thinking about what it all means and like whether you understand it and deeply making sense out of it at the same time as you're actually moving your pencil along and listening to your teacher and paying attention, right? What you need in order to be a really good learner is to be able to appropriately move between kind of reflection and deep learning and thinking and sort of sitting with stuff and imagining about it and trying it on and thinking about what it means on the one hand, and then listening and paying attention when it's the right time to do that. And that kind of executive functioning, usually in schooling, is not thought of that way. It's usually thought of as executive functioning as being your ability to attend, follow instructions, move your pencil on the paper when you're supposed to be, right? Finish your work and do what you're supposed to and know what's going on around you. And what our neuroscience is showing is that that kind of attention, of paying attention to the world and moving your pencil and attending, is actually only half the story. And by overprivileging that kind of attention in the way we design our schools and our environments for learning, we are potentially directly undermining people's long-term ability to connect their learning to who they are and to use it in a new context later, to really deeply understand and remember it. So I'm going to skip down now just to the very end with a little couple of examples from some teenagers that we've worked with in the lab. These are kids from inner city Los Angeles who are from very low SES backgrounds, who did a neuroscience camp with us and who have been studying neuroscience with us, right? And we were learning about how these kids actually engage with the learning process over time as they become sort of engaged learners through working with us. And what we're finding is that among these low SES kids from really poor immigrant families, right, their ability to engage compassionately with multiple perspectives on the complex problems that are in their communities and their worlds are actually related to their brain development, even at rest. So kids who were more compassionate in this way were actually showing more activity in these systems of the brain, like the default mode, that remove you from the current context, that allow you to think deeply and reflect and not just attend in the moment. All right. So just to sum up, I have a book that was mentioned at the beginning where a lot of this information is kind of laid out. It's, a couple of years old now, 2 years old now. I'm going to be writing another one soon, but not too soon. So if you are interested in exploring these ideas in more depth, I recommend it. And then I also just want to put in a plug for the International Mind, Brain, and Education Society Conference. I'm the president right now, so we're going to be hosting the conference in Los Angeles at the University of Southern California in September. Information about that will be posted on indus.org soon. It's an academic scholarly conference, but we invite practitioners to engage in the conversations with scientists about what the science means, and also to try to inform the science from the practitioner's perspective. So it's really a bidirectional, collaborative kind of conference in which we're trying to understand how people learn and how scientists and educators can work together to solve the problems that you need to know to really improve the way schools are run and designed. The conference moves all around the world. It's been in Ecuador and Toronto the last two conferences, and this time it's going to be right here in Los Angeles. So anybody nearby, I highly recommend coming. And thank you.
Mary Helen, I want to quote Mildred Parker from Alaska, who wrote on the chat, "Wow," in all caps. And I think that's how we all feel. We can't thank you enough. I know we're a little over time. What we're going to do is get to three questions. And for those of you who have stayed on, or even if you haven't, we'll let you know. We'll try to answer some more questions in the discussion. So please sign up for the community so we can keep the conversation going. First question is, how do we apply this knowledge in the classroom to facilitate engagement with our students? From Joyce Kaladke. And I apologize if I mispronounced the last name.
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question, Joyce.
Yeah,
but there's actually lots of really good pedagogical strategies that help. I think one of the ways is that we really need to start attending to the culture of the community of the classroom and not just to the learning outcomes, you know, and really providing things like a meaningful choices for students to study things they're interested in. And really setting up the environment of the classroom and the class so that kids follow on their interests and learn to think really complexly with each other about problems that are relevant in their world, using the skills that they need to be learning, like from math, from historical analysis, from writing, from arguing, and persuasive arguing and things like that. So I would recommend taking a look at things like really when it's really well down, project-based learning, like the way that the Buck Institute explains it, and also instituting meaningful choices in your classroom. And also, in age-appropriate ways, being really mindful of shifting classrooms so that they are about ideas and learning and not about behavior and management. Because when you engage kids in conversations about rules and behaviors, it's not that you don't have to have good rules and behaviors, but the thing is, if that's what the classroom is about, then kids sort of think of good schoolwork as kind of like what you do to look like you're doing good schoolwork. And some kids are able to kind of do that, and some kids turn out from that. But either way, they're not really learning. They need to be monitoring and steering themselves in a way that's actually conducive to learning and really engagement. So community discussions, interest-driven projects, ongoing process-oriented learning, as compared to sort of, you know, learn it, do a test, learn it, do a test, learn it, do a test, and then you're done, that kind of stuff.
Here's another quick one, Mary Helen. Virginia Link writes, I would love to have PD brought to my school about emotional intelligence and the significance of emotion in learning. Where might I go?
Oh, that's great. I mean, I can't endorse any particular group, but there are various people who have really good programs. You might ask Mark Brackett at Yale. I know that he's in a lot of schools with programs that he has. That's what I would recommend. I would recommend, rather than any particular group, is that to be sure that the work you're engaging with and the people you're engaging with are actually using evidence-based frameworks that are built out of research that's peer-reviewed and that's really rigorous and reliable as compared to sort of, you know, things that people kind of take a hunch toward liking, which we don't know if they work or not. That's why I like work like Mark's.
Right. And what we'll do is put this in we'll post in our community, the Buck Institute and Mark's work with Ruler and whatnot. Last question. And we hopefully we'll be able to ask you a couple more offline and get answers in the community. This is from Claudia Saborin. Is negative social engagement, such as getting bullied or being in a non-supportive environment, as detrimental as social neglect in terms of brain development?
I think it depends on the magnitude of both, but bullying and being in a social environment where a person doesn't feel safe is very bad for their emotional, physical, and emotional and physical health. And it's bad for, and things that are bad for your health are bad for your brain. So yes, it's really bad for you. Neglect and abuse are also bad for you. When you're not in a safe place where you can engage, the brain doesn't develop as well. Yep.
Right. I think you also made the comment too about you want an environment where it's sort of like where everybody knows your name. It's the cheers thing in an environment in schools that really bring out.
Right. Exactly.
Right.
And like they're genuinely
right.
safe to take risks and to try things and to be themselves.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And another thing that was so interesting you said too was on autonomy, how and it's sort of like the voice and choice for students, and but it also plays out for teachers, I think, as well. Mm-hmm. We are over time. I thank everyone who was able to stay and Mary Helen, I can't thank you enough. It was so exciting. I mean, Wendy and I are sitting here, we're thrilled. We finished reading your book. I would certainly suggest this for everyone. I'm not just pitching it. It's great. And then you can stare at the painting on the cover as long as you want.
It's a beautiful painting.
Maida, I appreciate everything you did as well. Thanks so much. And Mary Helen, I don't think you need to worry about Teddy.
We hope you enjoyed this EdWeb podcast. If you'd like to receive a CE certificate, you must watch the video recording and take the corresponding CE quiz. Recordings and quizzes can be found in the EdWebinar archives. Please visit home.edweb.net/podcasts for more information.